Today on Maine Calling, what letters and historical documents teach us about enslavement and abolition in Maine. For most people who grew up in Maine, school history did not acknowledge the state's role in slavery or the slave trade. In fact, many people had no idea that people in Maine had owned slaves. That picture of history changed less than a decade ago when a small handful of researchers uncovered documents such as census records and ship manifests. And now historians and genealogists are working to broaden that knowledge. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll find out about newer projects that focus on historical documents to learn more about Maine's past, particularly those who were enslaved and those who fought for abolition. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Support for Maine Calling comes from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org. And Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Perhaps because Maine is so far north, or perhaps because our history is a predominantly white state, there has long been an impression that slavery was non-existent in Maine. Well, over the past decade or so, more and more research is proving that wrong. Today, we're going to talk with three people who have done extensive research on enslaved people in Maine and on the abolitionist movement. Joining me, Vanna Carmona, who is the founder of The Prince Project, which focuses on the role of enslavement in Maine. Kathy Ostrander Roberts is a historian and author of the book Unmarked Graves and Forgotten Lives, which is about a settlement of formerly enslaved men and women who lived in the area around Kennebunk. She's also an artist and real estate agent. And Dr. Mary T. Freeman is Associate Professor of New England History at the University of Maine. Her recent book is Abolitionists and the Politics of Correspondence. Today's show is part of Maine Calling's coverage of the history tied to America's 250th birthday. We invite you to share your comments and questions. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you, and welcome back, Mary. Vanna, I want to start with you. We did a Maine Calling show back in 2020 about Maine's role in the slave trade, and it was surprising to many of our listeners, and for many people generally, that there were enslaved people in Maine, and that Maine played a significant role in the slave trade, including prominent ship captains, names that we know still today, have streets and parks named after them. You had also heard that slavery didn't really have a presence in Maine. Tell us about what you learned in school and then the discovery that sent you on your mission.
Well, I went to school for 13 years here in Portland, and I never heard a peep about enslavement in Maine. And I continued on to never hear about it at all, not from my family. They were, most of them had come into Maine in the early 1600s and 1700s. Absolutely nothing. And it was just one day, very suddenly, I was out in a cemetery where I had a lot of ancestors buried, and I found a stone that said Prince on it. And I said, "Who is he? I haven't heard of him." And I thought I knew everybody in the family. And I went home, and fortunately there was some information on him, and discovered he'd been enslaved by my very own ancestors. And I was very upset. I was upset that my ancestors were involved in this, and I was also upset that I'd never been taught, because I felt that it was something that should have been taught.
It's interesting to me that Prince had a gravestone, because I know that much of this work is really difficult because there are unmarked graves. That's one of the many reasons it's difficult. What do you know about how Prince came to have a headstone?
Well, actually, that's pretty interesting, because there's no way that his enslavers gave him a headstone, because first of all, they were dead. My theory on this is that it was put up years later, probably in the 1860s or 70s. There were a lot of ancestors, a lot of descendants, excuse me, a lot of descendants from this particular family that sort of had gotten very interested in genealogy. That was very popular at the time to get interested in your genealogy. And I seriously believe that they're the ones that put up the stone. And one of the reasons for that is because it turns out we found some evidence recently that nobody even knew exactly what date he had even died. So how could you put up a stone if you didn't even know what date he died? So that stone came later, and that's why it has all that information about how he came from Africa, etc. It was not put up because he was a beloved enslaved person, so to speak.
All right, and that launched that led you to launch the Prince Project, which I'm going to come back to because I want to get some other voices here. Kathy, I know that you've also been doing extensive research and now have a book out about what you've learned. Tell us what set you into motion into looking into the history of enslaved people around Kennebunk.
Oh gosh, about 2008, I was appointed the local town historian by the town. And part of that was to research some of the cemeteries in the area. And in that process, I kept coming across written histories of the freed slave settlement. And I thought, well, where the heck is that? And we've not talked about that and haven't seen anything about that. So I started digging in deeds and probate records and census, whatever I could find to find out where this so-called community was. And it took me a good long while. I think I've been at it about 25 years. And I did finally located it and was able to spearhead several archaeological digs at the site. So it's pretty fascinating. My quest began basically because I'm trying to protect ancient cemeteries from being built upon, and this was one of those.
Were you surprised by what you found when you started digging?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like Vanna, I grew up in upstate landlocked New York and never heard of slavery in New England, and it just wasn't mentioned. It was always Southern slavery and the Civil War. So the more I dug into this, and the more I learned that people all around me my age had never been educated on this subject. So yeah, it was very surprising, and to see that it was such a large community, at the time, one census, 1790 census said something like 17 people, and they would have been free at that time. But that's a large community, one of the largest freed communities in Maine.
Mary, give us the big picture of slavery in, well, I'm going to say Maine, even though it was part of Massachusetts back then. What was the time period in which people, enslaved people, were living and working in Maine? Do we know how many, or are we still figuring that out?
Well, I'd say the work of projects like the Prince Project is helping us to figure that out. But slavery in Maine existed from the earliest years of colonization of the region, Maine, and the broader region of New England, and into Atlantic Canada as well. So dating back to the early 1600s, there were enslaved people of African descent. There were also indigenous people. Local to the region who were enslaved sometimes within the region, or sometimes they were enslaved sent elsewhere, to the West Indies, for example. And, the institution of slavery continued in Maine and New England into the 1700s, the 18th century. So it really wasn't until the time of the American Revolution that individual states began to reckon with this issue and passed laws, or in the case of Maine, as part of Massachusetts, there was never exactly a law passed, but it was an interpretation of the new state constitution of Massachusetts that came out in 1780 that led to the legal end to slavery in Maine and Massachusetts. But we can probably talk more about this. There were many connections to slavery in Maine that extended beyond that, clear end date, to the legality of enslavement in Maine in 1780.
Well, tell me what, happened in 1780? Were people who were enslaved just set free? I mean, how did that work? Or do we know?
That is a fabulous question, and it's as everything in history, it's complicated. And historians are still trying to figure out exactly how the end of slavery unfolded in Maine and New England, and throughout, what becomes the United States in that period. It's really the initiative of enslaved people themselves. I think that's where scholars and, researchers have landed on that question for at least for now. You see enslaved people taking matters in their own hands as much as they can, especially during the American Revolution. There's a lot of disruption and upheaval going on everywhere. But that opens up some opportunities for enslaved people to, make claims to having a stake in this conflict, either by, joining the military on either the American or the British side, running away when things are confused and they can get away, or simply negotiating for greater rights and freedom where they are based on, the values that are being espoused in things like the Declaration of Independence about all men being created equal. So, thinking about the moment where we are on the brink of the 250th anniversary of the American Revolution, it's a great time to think about, how different groups of people have used the values in that document to hold the United States accountable to the principles there. And you definitely see that with enslaved people using various channels within formal, legal, and political realms, as well as on a more ad hoc, informal basis to better their circumstances in that period.
Vana.
I was just also going to add to that one of the things that's always a surprise to me, well, it's not a surprise anymore after 13 years of this, is that in reading some of the things about slavery ending here in Massachusetts and Maine, it always talks about abolition, and it certainly absolutely is not abolition. That sounds good, but it's not true. It really was never a legislative decision. It was a judicial decision in which people simply could no longer take documents into a court and say, I own this person. You couldn't do that. So if you couldn't do that, then they were by default free. But I also always add, so it's like slavery discontinued. It wasn't abolition. But the culture, it seemed like, of people living in with their quote unquote former enslavers, the culture of enslavement continued.
And Kathy.
I just wanted to add to that question. Here in Kennebunk, too, I think that the people who finally had their freedom, what they did is they took, and many of those who had obtained their freedom, they ended up living with their enslavers even after the fact. And that was very, very common. So it was interesting to find that here in Kennebunk, they started their own community. They built their own homes. And the archaeology is pretty fascinating that shows how they transitioned from slavery to freedom in what they ate, what they, that they had livestock. It's just fascinating to see tangible evidence of that transition.
Kathy, for folks who aren't that familiar with your area of Maine, where would you describe this settlement as being?
At the time, we were part of Wells, and obviously, it was the northern section of Wells that was known as Kennebunk, and it's located on what we call High Street now, and it's in a state forest. Part of it is in a state forest, but what we've learned is there's a larger community. There's some in the state forest, there's some across the High Street Road. There were some individuals living at a distance of 2 or 3 miles, so there was a large community at that time.
Interesting. Vana, we've mentioned the Prince Project a couple times now, so I want you to tell me about it. You told us about Prince and what a little bit of what you've been able to learn about him. What is the Prince Project?
Well, when I found him, I thought, first thing I did is I said, well, I wonder if there's a database somewhere of all these, to find out more about who was enslaved in Maine. And I discovered that there wasn't. So, but I thought, well, I'll just see who else. It never dawned on me what I was getting into. I was just kind of, I'll find a few names, I'll write them on a list. And I found some more, and then I found some more, and then I found some more. And then I finally, I had been down, my whole research path between the internet and going down to the Historical Society, whatever I could find. And then it just started growing. And then I had to keep changing how I was keeping track of everybody. My goal was to find the individuals, the people, because I didn't want them lost. I didn't want them lost like prints being lost. So I just would say like, oh, this weekend I'm going to work on prints, so it became the Prints Project. And then of course it was only 3 years ago that we finally changed it to a nonprofit 501c3,
So you're a
but
nonprofit, it's a database, and you have people, other people like you who are doing this research and entering what they find, right?
well, what we've done is I've done a lot of the research. Kathy certainly contributed over time. More in the beginning, it was hard. People didn't, when I told them what I was doing, they told me that I was crazy, that nobody was enslaved. They were just servants. I kept hearing that for years. I said, but what is this bill of sale I'm looking at? So finally, about I would say it was probably 2018, about the George Floyd time, it started to shift. But I've always wanted people to contribute anything they found. And even this past weekend, Kathy and I were talking to some people locally here in Maine who gave us a lot of really great data, and we're going to add that into the data. The database now has 2,300 people on it, just
So
FYI.
when we're looking at scale, I think that people are thinking small scale, but 2,300 people, these are names. You have 2,300 names and places where they lived and years that they were here. And you are using documents like bills of sale. These are not documents that someone can question easily.
Well, of course, there's always anything. I figure if anyone gets mentioned. So, yes, we've also used oral histories, but we've got bills of sale, census records, church records. Kathy knows this too. She's done a lot of the same kind of thing. So, anywhere you can find anything, but I don't want anyone left behind. So, even if it's oral history, it's fine. Maybe we'll find something to substantiate it later.
Kathy.
What I find fascinating about the research that Vana and I have done thus far, I find it fascinating that that the history wasn't ever talked about. There was no education about it. However, all of this data was out there. It wasn't that there was a lack of history. There were, like Vana said, there was probate records, church records, all kinds of records available, newspapers, military records. So the data was always out there, but people chose to ignore it, and that's the what hits home with me all the time.
Well, we do need to take a break, but when we come back, Mary, I want to ask you about your new book as well. So we will talk about the abolitionist and what you learned from some of the letters that you've been reading. We are talking about slavery and abolition, and we're talking about Maine history and what happened right here where we live. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about researchers who are using documentation to learn more about the history of enslavement and abolition in our area. My guests today have all revealed new information by digging through records, letters, and other historical sources. With me, the town historian for Kennebunk, Kathy Ostrander Roberts. Her new book is called Unmarked Graves and Forgotten Lives. UMaine history professor Mary T. Freeman also has a new book out. It is called Abolitionists and the Politics of Correspondence, and Vana Carmona founded the Prince Project to uncover the history of slavery in Maine and to correct historical narratives. Join the conversation. Have you heard stories in your family or your neighborhood about enslaved people in Maine? Are you curious about how abolitionists find the doc? Excuse me, about how these researchers find the documents that they do. You can send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Mary, before I ask you about your book, I want to ask you about something Kathy said before the break, which is that these records were there all along. and that it just took a matter of somebody looking for them. And I'm thinking somebody even asking the question. It seems as though for a long time, we didn't ask the question. We didn't want to know.
Yeah, I mean, Maine definitely has a strong connection to its abolitionist heritage and to, you know, having strong support for the Union cause during the American Civil War. And, you know, I think as part of the 19th century swelling of support for the abolition of slavery on a national scale that, you know, of course, peaks around the time of the Civil War. And then afterwards, there's efforts to kind of commemorate that effort. During that period is when Maine, and this is true throughout New England, kind of forgot about its own history and connections to enslavement. I study and write about abolitionists, and actually abolitionists before the Civil War called a lot of attention to Northern ties to slavery, both through historical, you know, enslavement of people in New England, as well as ongoing economic ties to the institution of slavery through the Civil War. But it was sort of in the aftermath of the Civil War where people were perhaps looking back on their legacy and the region's legacy with a bit of rose-tinted glasses that a lot of this history was forgotten or even intentionally kind of erased or scrubbed out from local memory. So that's had consequences up through today in terms of how we understand our own history here in Maine.
And Mary, I want to, earlier this year, we learned on a different Maine Calling program that the abolitionists, I think a lot of people think of them as the majority of folks in Maine in the late 1700s and throughout the first half of the 1800s. But that we learned that that's really not true, that these folks are really outliers. Many of them thought of as really out there, and that most of the public disagreed with them. You have uncovered letters between them. Tell me what letters can teach us about how they thought, how they worked, how they did what they did that we didn't know before.
Well, you're absolutely right to point out that abolitionists were a quite small but vocal minority of white Northerners, you know, leading up to the Civil War. There were a lot of Black abolitionists who were strong supporters of abolishing slavery all the way back to the era of the Revolution. But the 19th century movement, you know, was definitely considered to be quite radical. You know, just its membership that included Black and white people, men and women, people of varying socioeconomic and regional backgrounds. It was a quite diverse movement, but was, you know, a radical minority at the time. And abolitionists could be really taking a lot of risks by expressing themselves publicly. They did a lot to disseminate their ideas through, you know, printed publications, newspapers, periodicals, as well as in-person traveling lecturers. But those people could be the victims of mob violence. They could be criticized. Their reputations could be damaged. They could be arrested for breaking state or federal laws. So it was quite risky to be an abolitionist, even up through the outbreak of the Civil War. So by looking at letter writing, I'm kind of looking at a hidden side to the abolitionist movement that doesn't reveal itself as obviously as some of their public actions. I'm looking at how, you know, letters could be a kind of semi-private or sheltered space for activists to organize, to communicate with one another, to kind of work out their ideas before expressing them publicly, and to, you know, sometimes participate in covert actions, including helping fugitives from slavery to escape without, you know, with a slightly less of a risk of being exposed than if they were more out there about what they were doing.
Great. We're going to go to a caller. Carl's calling from Stowe, Maine. Hi, Carl. Go ahead.
Good morning. You mentioned earlier the ships and so forth. And cargo ships, when they ship oil or coal, usually carry their cargo one way. But the slave trade worked this way. The enslaved indigenous people didn't make very good slaves here in New England because they were so close to home. Further, many of them who were enslaved, it was a sentence for them, and they could be a slave 2 or 3 years, but they didn't like that. So here is how the cargo went. The ships would take the indigenous slaves to the Caribbean, where they would then be swapped out for Caribbean slaves and brought north along with sugar, which was the primary commodity. So you have this extremely lucrative slave trade going both ways. And that is just another factor in the slave trade here in New England. I might also just mention parenthetically that Cotton Mather actually had a slave that had been a gift to him. And I will leave that tidbit with you.
Carl, thank you for your call. Mary, this is the first time in my recollection that we have talked about folks who are indigenous being taken from Maine and taken, you know, put into slavery, enslaved in other parts of the world. Do we know how many people? Do we have any idea?
Again, I think this is a subject of ongoing research, but it speaks to some of the work that the Prince Project is doing as well. But also, just, you know, to add to what the caller was saying, you know, it speaks to how essential Maine's maritime economy was from the very beginnings of colonization and how deeply that economy was tied into the institution of slavery on a much broader geographic level. So, you know, the fact that enslaved people of both indigenous and African descent were being transported on Maine-made ships, as well as the complete reliance of the economy on that coasting trade down to the West Indies and bringing back commodities, especially sugar, that were produced with enslaved labor. The wealth of, you know, early colonial Maine, some of those wealthy families, ship captains' houses, all of that came from the institution of slavery.
Ivana.
I didn't realize it when I first started studying this 13 years ago, but it only took a couple years to realize that exactly what Mary's saying is that our whole economy was absolutely based in one way or another on enslaved labor. And so there's a point where it's basically, if you were involved in any kind of shipping, whether it was shipbuilding or whatever, then you were involved and complicit in the enslavement, in enslavement in Maine. And it's also true, I definitely have found accounts where some of the indigenous people were rounded up, whether it was in some sort of a battle or just in general, and were shipped out. And the gentleman is absolutely correct that in order to really enslave somebody, you have to always isolate them. That's why coming from Africa, you're stripped of your culture, your language, your name, everything. And then you're plopped down and said, you're a slave now.
Kathy.
I did want to add that although, yes, many were sent, indigenous people were sent to the West Indies and various other places. We have many records of several who were enslaved right here in Maine. I have 1751 poll tax records that denote that each town had X number of slaves and X number of Indians, and their value in 1751 at 13 pounds each sometimes exceeded the cost of the value of homes, but they actually were being enslaved right here and not sent elsewhere, those people. So
Carl, thank you.
I have some of those records. I see also, I do, when I find somebody who's that had in whatever documents we find that say that they were indigenous and they were enslaved, then they go on the Prince Project for sure, on our
That's
database.
True.
Carl, thank you so much for your call. Let's see, a few emails coming in here. I'll go to this one. I'm interested in learning more about the role of the Gardiner family, both in transatlantic trade in slaves and later in trans-Pacific trade in Chinese, and he's using quotes here, coolies. Does anybody know about the Gardiner family and Is that?
Yes, I know about the Gardner family. They were actually in Massachusetts, and they had land up here, which is now, by the way, Gardner, and Pittston and Hollowell. So they had land up here. It's kind of a complicated history, so I'm not quite sure about Gardner's trade with China or anything like that. But I certainly know that he was involved. He was an enslaver. He was, well-to-do, and he was connected to Maine. But there's a long, long story there,
All
so
right.
we don't have
Peter
time to
asked
do it
in an
all today.
email, the town of Searsport is proud of its seafaring heritage. Is there evidence of Searsport captains' involvement in the slave trade? Mary, do we know specifically if some of the captains, I mean, all you have to do is drive through Searsport and see all those big, beautiful houses to know that there were sea
Yeah,
captains
well,
there.
I would certainly plug the Penobscot Marine Museum as a great resource on this topic. I believe they've done exhibitions and research related to this. And I can't tell you any specific names of people or families, but I think just echoing kind of the conversation we've had, it speaks to how you could go up and down Maine's coast and look in every single coastal community. And find these historical connections without really having to scratch the surface too deeply. Again, it's a matter of a few generations, perhaps, in which this history has been forgotten. But if you go back even to histories of local towns that were published back in the 19th century, you can often find reference to enslavement and involvement in Atlantic trading that involves slavery. And there's, I mean, it just shows you there's so much more out there to be discovered and learned, but the pattern is certainly there.
We'll
To
go to
Mary's
Ron
point, I
from. Go ahead. Go
go ahead.
ahead. That's fine. I
No,
was going to go to
just
another call. Kathy, go ahead.
Just to Mary's point, similar here in Kennebec and other towns, the whole narrative is wealthy ship captains, and you see the mansions, and then you dig deeper and you realize that all of that was built on the backs of slavery. So it's kind of an eye opener. So I wouldn't be surprised about Searsport either.
Yeah. And you mentioned sugar
Sure.
before, which of course was important in rum, but we can't forget cotton because in all the mills in New England. We'll go to Ron calling from Waldoboro. Hi, Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. So I've read, thank you for this panel and topic. I've read a while ago Jasper Stahl's History of Waldoboro, so it's apposite to what you've just been talking about with the shipbuilding, which was Waldoboro's, fortune in those days, and built the community as being the first or second largest port in New England or the Atlantic coast, and all that business. And so, but in the book of Jasper Stahl's History of Broad Bay, he gives very little reference to either the indigenous population, which I referred to as savages. Actually, there were four wars that the Indians fought against the colonial settlers. And he does mention the Underground Railroad, but very little discussion of the whole abolitionist period or what that was about. And so I was wondering and whether you actually had specific research or could point to research on, and I think others would be interested in this, the ships and captains that actually did trade in the Caribbean and Jamaica and so forth, and in one way or another, and profited handsomely from the whole enslavement period.
Ron, are you
So
asking
that's my
specifically
question.
about ships from Waldoboro or from Maine generally?
Yeah, from Waldoboro, but yeah, from Waldoboro. There was a settlement in a black community in Warren too, which I don't know if anybody's mentioned here yet. But
Okay,
yes, in
so well, let's ask
Waldoboro,
the
the
two questions.
community
I'll have
hall.
Vanna tell us about the settlement. She knows about the settlement in Warren, but do any of you know about specific ship captains from Waldoboro?
Well, I would also recommend Kate McMahon, who is a historian at Castine Historical Society and who's done a lot of research about this whole topic of, you know, maritime connections and economic profits tied to slavery in the Maine coast. And also she's connected to the Atlantic Black Box Project, which also has a lot of research on this topic. So those are two resources that I would suggest reaching out to if you're interested in that topic.
I think there's some actual databases they've created that names ships and where they sailed and those that did were involved in the slave trade. It's pretty fascinating.
Right.
I think it's called Slave Voyages. Is that the name of the database?
I think that's what I was trying to remember.
And Kate McMahon has done fabulous work on this for the last few years. She'd be a great resource for you. You know, and you folks also, if you go to the Prince Project database is up online. You can search it. You go to our website, princeproject.org, go to database, and you can search and see if you can find anything that way too. And if you find anything that's not included in the database, by all means, let us know.
And Vanna, you said you did know about the settlement that Ron was talking about that's in Warren.
Yes. Yeah. The Peters family. Yeah. And Kate McMahon, again, is a fabulous researcher for that. She did a huge amount of research on that Warren. It was Sarah Peters and the whole family, and they settled up there, kind of like the Ridge community, et cetera, and then expanded from there. Fascinating story.
It's fascinating because Kate McMahon was on Maine Calling in 2020 when we originally did a program about slavery in Maine. And she was talking about going into historical societies and people were not happy to see her. They were not happy about the question she was asking. And I'm wondering if you all have had that same experience.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we definitely, all of us probably have come up against a lot of resistance. People just were insulted by the thought of it, that we were exploring something that they clearly didn't think existed.
Ron, thank you for your questions. So many questions coming in, but we do have to take another quick break. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about information that is coming to light about the lives of enslaved people and those working to ensure their freedom. We're talking with some of the people working to uncover this previously hidden history. My guest, Mary Freeman, who is an associate professor of New England history at UMaine, Vanna Carmona, founder of the Prince Project, and Kathy Ostrander Roberts, historian and author focused on the Ridge Settlement in southern coastal Maine. Share your comments and questions. Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or if you're quick, give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Mary, you sent me a note talking about the connection between the revolution and abolitionism. Here we are about at the 250th anniversary. What is the connection?
Well, actually, the opening scene of my book is in 1773 in Boston, where a group of enslaved and formerly enslaved Black men wrote a letter representing what they called their committee, so suggesting that there was a broader level of organization going on, where they argued that, you know, as Massachusetts colonists were starting to talk about the potential to break away from Great Britain, and were actually using the language of slavery to describe their relationship to you know, the monarchy, to Great Britain, saying they were enslaved to the British crown. Enslaved people and free people of African descent started to, you know, use that as an argument to say, hey, slavery itself actually exists here. And if you're using that kind of language and argument, then you should really think seriously about the institution of slavery. So, you know, I argue in my book that we should not only look to 19th century abolitionism, but we should look even earlier to the period of the American Revolution, where you have enslaved and free Black people starting to work together to build, you know, an abolitionist movement that early on. You know, amid the kind of disruption of revolutionary politics and then the outbreak of the war. So, you know, as we start to commemorate this, you know, 250th anniversary, it's also, to me, an anniversary that speaks to kind of the radical activism of abolitionism that started to happen in that period, led by enslaved and formerly enslaved people.
We'll go to Mary calling from Saco. Hi, Mary. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention on a sort of universal level that many people don't know or understand about the enslavement of Africans was that when the British Royal Company put the enacted slavery for their colonies, it was chattel slavery. And that's something that makes it different from any kind of slavery that existed before or after Africans were enslaved. In other words, they were enslaved forever, and their children were enslaved forever. And that's a very different kind of slavery. It's not the kind of slavery that somebody like Ron DeSantis talks about. And I think that's a significant difference and one that people should understand.
Thank you, Mary.
Go ahead, Lana.
I was going to say, absolutely. There's been slavery all through societies all over the world since it seems like the beginning of time, but you don't see this kind of slavery, this chattel slavery. Certainly, it was a whole new approach. And even when we started to see people of African descent coming into Maine in the early 1600s, it was throughout the 1600s that it really changed. Originally, it wasn't the chattel slavery that we're discussing here, but throughout, by the end of the 1600s, it certainly was.
Mm. And Kathy?
You can especially see that when you look at old and estate inventories, and they list persons of color right along with the cows and the horses as, you know, just individual, not as individuals, but as chattel. Yeah. And they just they'll say something, Phyllis Negro wench, 30 pounds. And she's listed right alongside as the kitchen utensils and the animals.
Mm. Mary, thank you for your call. All three of you, I want to ask you the same question, which is why, in your view, is it so important? And Vanna, I'll start with you, to make people aware of what happened so long ago. Why are you so very compelled to make sure the Prince Project captures every name?
Well, I don't want these people forgotten, because I think it's offensive that this is the way we were teaching our history for all these centuries. And I think it's just simply wrong. I was offended that this wasn't taught to me. I don't want it taught, this whitewashed history. I don't want it taught to my children or my grandchildren. I think that it's, when we talk about history, it is history. It's all the details. You don't just say, oh, well, this part doesn't count, because it does. It counts a lot, because these people contributed to what we have today. And to say that they didn't count, they didn't exist, it's just simply, it just seems to me personally, it's morally wrong. And I know that my ancestors were involved in all of this, and that's hard enough, but there's a personal involvement, and I have to help rewrite this history correctly.
Kathy?
Similar. We're some of all of our parts. We're all the facets. We're not just the, you know, the fancy narrative of ship captains. We are the people who work to build our communities. And I don't want these people forgotten either. I want them named, because their lives did have consequence. So it's that. And I really want to, I'm doing it because I want the education to go forward. I don't want it to be something that's not talked about in schools any longer.
And Mary?
Well, I certainly agree that there's a moral obligation to learn this history, so I reinforce that point. But also, as someone who teaches American history on a daily basis, you can't tell the story of the United States or the story of Maine and New England and have it make sense without including the topic of slavery. I mean, as we've talked about during this call today, the, you know, economic basis of Maine and New England, the, you know, trajectory of colonization from its very beginnings in this region was undergirded by a reliance on slavery as, you know, a labor force, as a generating enormous wealth and kind of keeping that project of colonization going. And then, you know, by the time you get to the 19th century, the economy of the United States as a whole is completely undergirded by wealth generated by enslaved labor. And that's true in the North and the South. So the story just doesn't make sense if you leave slavery out. Just to touch a little bit, since I also, you know, write about abolitionism, to be perhaps a little bit more of an optimistic note, I also think it's really important to understand that history in a complete and, you know, well-documented way, because there's a lot of myth and romanticization of that movement. But also, you know, we can learn a lot from these activists who put themselves out there, took their lives in their own hands, took a lot of risks to speak out against this institution as something that was immoral in their own time, even though it was widely accepted. So we can learn a lot from, you know, the activists who opposed slavery, even when it was this driving force behind the national economy.
We've got a Sean calling from Biddeford. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi. A lot of the conversation today is focused on the past. So I was wondering if your guests had done any research on the 13th Amendment, which allows for slavery and involuntary servitude to continue as punishment for a crime.
Mary.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, as a historian, I have to say it's a long and winding road from 1865 to 2026. But, you know, I think this is, you know, connecting my research of activists of the 19th century to activism of the present. People who advocate for prison abolition and the rights of prisoners today point to the era of the Civil War and Reconstruction as, you know, a period where slavery as we knew it ended at that time, but there were loopholes left in to the 13th Amendment that allowed for incarcerated labor that closely resembled the institution of slavery. And that, you know, happened in the South, you know, in the Jim Crow era with convict labor. And it's something that continues to be an issue today that, you know, activists continue to confront. And you know, there, it just shows that even at a moment in history where we made a lot of progress, that there were things that were not resolved that we still reckon with today.
Sean, thanks for your call. Let's see. We'll go to Melissa in Surrey. Hi, Melissa. Go ahead.
Hi. If I remember correctly, last year, maybe one of your guests gave a lecture down in Castine, and I unfortunately missed it. And I'm just wondering if there are any lectures happening this year.
And Melissa, so her name's Carol Gardner, and yes, she was on Maine Calling. And Bridget just emailed in to say that Carol Gardner is speaking Saturday, June 20th at 2 p.m. At the Alna Meeting House, Damariscotta and Newcastle Ships of the Slave Trade. So that's June 20th at the Alna Meeting House. And we have an email here from Eric Smith, who's executive director of the Freeport Historical Society. He says, Freeport Historical Society is examining Black and Indigenous history before and during the Revolution in its two new exhibits, including Black and Indigenous Veterans of the Revolution. Our local collections have been key to recovering some of the history that has been long obscured, including the anomaly of having no race column in the 1800 census in the town of Freeport. So thank you so much. I understand, Vanna, you're also doing an event. Go ahead.
Yeah, actually, Kathy and I have done several events about Blacks associated with Maine who were in the Revolution. And I'm also doing on the 25th of this month at Rice Library in Kittery, I call it the Introduction to Enslavement in Maine, in which I talk about the early people that came in, the systems that were used, and how it was part of a global history as well. So,
Donna, you also do that Eastern Cemetery tour. That's fascinating.
I'm going to also do, this will be the third season that I'll be doing an Eastern Cemetery in Portland. On this would be on the 27th of this month. This will be the first one at 2 o'clock at the cemetery. You can sign up on Eventbrite, or you can just come along at 2 o'clock on the 27th.
Well, we're out of time. I apologize to anyone whose question we didn't get to. I want to read Bill's comment on Facebook. He says, "I was one of the archaeologists that worked with Kathy on the site in Kennebunk. Congratulations on your new book. I'm looking forward to it." So thank you all. And he's talking about Kathy Ostrander Roberts, her new book, Unmarked Graves and Forgotten Lives. Vanna Carmona is the founder of The Prince Project. And Dr. Mary T. Freeman, associate professor of history at UMaine, whose recent book is Abolitionist and the Politics of Correspondence. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.